There are many kinds of museums. From the supersized Smithsonian to the childhood home of Muhammad Ali, from Bangkok to Boston, and everywhere in between. But museum goers only see part of the full picture. On this show, we open the crates, tell the stories, meet the people, and reveal the inner workings, unseen, unheard, until now. From Philbrook Museum of Art and Public Radio Tulsa, I'm your host, Jeff Martin, and this is Museum Confidential. A few years ago, the National Museum of Women in the Arts in Washington, D.C., posed a simple question on their social media. Can you name 5 women artists? Simple, easy. This 6-word question and the hashtag 5 women artists that went with it placed a much-needed spotlight on the lack of general knowledge regarding women artists. That campaign is still going year after year, but the question remains. Think about it. Can you name 5 women artists? One person who most certainly can is author Bridget Quinn. Her book, Broad Strokes, 15 Women Who Made Art and Made History in That Order, is the perfect primer for this discussion. So I guess I would like to begin with talking about the origins of the book project, meaning you focused on these 15 artists and obviously, those aren't the only 15 you could choose from. So,
in the history of the world.
What was the winnowing process like? Because you're trying to make, I guess, paint a larger picture with these 15 who are more representative of the whole, right?
Right. Well, just to begin with, the number 15 comes from the fact that my art history textbook as an undergraduate in the 1980s was, I think, the 5th edition of Janssen's The History of Art, and for the first time ever had 16 women artists in it, in 800 pages from Australopithecus to Andy Warhol.
Which was seen as a big improvement at
yes,
the time.
Yes, yeah. As one of my professors said, women with their clothes on. That's obviously, there was no way to resurrect the entire history of women in Western art. But so, yes, to pick representative examples starting in the Renaissance. So I tried to find women whose work, in a way, the book could be a kind of art history primer from the late Renaissance to now. So that was the first basic framework, that we would have 15 artists. There were 16 in Janssen. There's a little twist in the book by the end. 15 artists, then I would try and cover representative periods in Western art. But then also artists that I had some kind of passionate engagement with.
So if you're starting and you're making this list, who are the ones that, you don't have to give me the 10, but like who are the 3 or 4 that you just knew from day one, this book would not be a representative book if these people were not in the book?
So the people I was determined to have in the book, There were 2.
2 of the 15.
Right? Yeah. I mean, I had a big list.
Yeah.
The 2 I absolutely had to have for me were Adelaide Le Billard, who is an 18th century French painter who's extremely underknown, not just to general audiences, but to even knowledgeable audiences. Yeah. And then Paula Modersohn Becker, who was a German modernist, late 19th, early 20th century artist. And I kind of built it after that. I also needed to pick people where I felt like I could tell a story that encapsulated something telling within their biography and within their art. So, for example, I picked Artemisia Gentileschi as opposed to other Renaissance women artists, partly because her art was really representative of an important story.
Do you have to appreciate their work for them to be an important person in history to make this list? Meaning, sometimes
list.
The biography.
Yeah.
Is as important to history as the actual work product. You know what I'm saying? Like,
yeah. Well, I guess I would say a couple of things. One is that I think it is a lie of art history that that is not the case.
Okay.
Right? That the work, that there's this level of connoisseurship where the excellence of the work is all and the biography is completely immaterial. Why do people love Van Gogh? Well, yes, his work is very compelling and very beautiful. It's also because it's a perfect myth of the tragic artist for the 20th century.
Because people can't separate the persona from the work.
Right.
Nor do they want to. Really.
And they don't want to. And it also explains why there's really no other explanation for why discovering that a work we thought was by Jacques-Louis David, for example, great 18th century French neoclassical painter, when it turns out it was by a almost unknown woman artist, why that work's quality is suddenly considered much inferior to what it was when it was believed to be by David. The work is the same, but the story changes.
You've worked in around the art world for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
You worked in museums in the 1990s when, you know, working in the museum in the early 1990s in a lot of ways was not dissimilar from working in a museum in the 1960s in a lot of ways, in the sense of, you know,
totally.
Technology was kind of at a weird place where internet was not
there. Was
quite
no
there.
Technology. There was zero.
And so, and also the power structures were still in kind of a locked in a way. When you first got into the museum world, did you feel the gender imbalance in a real way?
Huge.
Yeah.
Absolutely. So, for example, I went to the Institute of Fine Arts, which is part of NYU, that was just a few blocks away from the Met. And the student body there was well over 50% female. And I had one woman professor in the entire faculty at the time. The head of the Met was a man. The head of the Guggenheim was a man. The head of MoMA was a man. They're all still men.
Yeah, yeah.
Women aren't always, I mean, the thing is, women live under patriarchy too, and
yeah.
are instructed by it too. And so, you know, in the when the Guerrilla Girls started in the 1980s, and they went out to shame galleries for not showing women artists, there were as many galleries owned and run by women not showing women as owned and run by men. So, I mean, maybe it will change. I don't know. Like the Baltimore Museum, the director's a man,
yeah.
and they've started that initiative. I think, like, a lot of representation, it takes all of us to be willing to dig in, and we're all made richer for it.
The Guerrilla Girls are an interesting example because of their kind of innate adversarial nature, but also with a great deal of humor.
Yeah,
and
key.
Do we have enough people with that much attitude now? It seems like it's there's more people at the table, but it seems
yeah.
more polite than it used to be. And I wonder if the politeness curtails progress.
You know, everything just seems so safe and so you gotta, like I told you about, I don't want to talk about my kids too much, but they don't feel like they can become artists. They don't think that they can make a living. They don't think that they can survive. And I think, so what?
Is that because, and partly, do you think that's partly because we've taught them to think
yeah.
that success is only one thing and that they see a safety net that's like, well, you know.
Well, I think they feel like they need a safety net
yeah.
and they do,
yeah.
right? And that's really clear to them that housing, student loans, et cetera, medical, those things are expensive.
Whereas, like,
and
the punk rock ethos was like, comfort, you know, who cares about comfort? I just want freedom, basically.
Right, freedom was hugely important. And I do think the time is right for a punk rock movement.
Yeah.
I really do. And for Riot Girl and Guerrilla
that
Girls.
That is. You know,
right, I don't know what it'll be.
Punk rock and people think of
I know.
Sex Pistols.
Yeah, yeah.
It's like, whatever, punk is more the philosophy of just like.
More like the fuck you to things and to not care so much. The careerism in everything just wears me down and makes me sad. And you see it all the way down to high school students. They feel like they have to have the perfect GPA and the perfect portfolio or whatever it is to get some box checked that's going to get them to the place. I mean, there used to be this joke in the movie Baby Boom with Diane Keaton. Was
yeah.
that like the 80s, right? Or the
yeah.
90s at the most. And the joke in the movie was she's at this playground with all these parents with toddlers, and they're asking her if she got her toddler into the right preschool, because if she didn't get into the right preschool, she wouldn't get in the right kindergarten, then she wouldn't go to the right grade school, then she wouldn't get into Harvard.
Which was like,
oh,
prescient.
Satire.
Prescient.
And it's reality. I mean, I had that conversation in Parks in San Francisco.
Yeah.
And that just bums me out. Like, that's not what, I don't think, what life is for. And I mean, the thing I want to impart to my kids the most is to just, like, seize your life. I personally think the kids are all right, yeah, and everything's going to be fine, yeah, for them.
I always say I'm a long-term optimist.
I am too.
Short-term pessimist.
Same exact. Yeah. Mostly, my daughter wants to be a firefighter, and it never occurs to her that there's a reason why she wouldn't do that.
Yeah, and that's progress in and
completely,
of itself, right?
Completely. So yeah. I'm all for it. That's great.
Yeah.
Today's episode of Museum Confidential is brought to you by Giant Heavy Art-Themed Coffee Table Books. When you just can't go to the museum, or really anywhere for that matter, these big weighty tomes are finally something more than just decorations for your house. Look at them. Learn a little bit. Hell, if you have enough, build a fort. There's nothing quite like that moment when the useless becomes useful. Get yourself some art coffee table books pronto.
You have a new book that is not out yet, but it's coming out soon. And we were talking about the obvious reasons for why we're talking about broad strokes, but tied into the 100th anniversary of women's suffrage, but this book really specifically is about that. Can you kind of tell us a little preview about what to expect?
Sure. Well, it's called She Votes, How U.S. Women Won Suffrage and What Happened Next. So it is a...
Subtitles are very important.
They're
very important.
A big deal. They're very long. I like the two-word title, yeah, but the subtitles get long.
Okay. She Votes.
She Votes. And, you know, the thing is, I mean, I hate to say this, but Americans are terrible at history. We forget our history very quickly. So kind of like broad strokes, it's a primer on women's history in the United States from the winning of suffrage.
In relation to the vote specifically? Or how far back are you going?
I go back to the American Revolution, but very quickly.
Yeah.
And really try and center some of the stories that haven't been told, but also to center the reasons things happened the way they did. So, for example, the Seneca Falls Convention, which is where Elizabeth Cady Stanton specifically says in 1848, women need to have the vote, which was beyond scandalous. I mean, it was crazy town, crazy. Well, why did this happen in this tiny upstate New York town? Not in Philadelphia, not in Boston, not in New York City. It happens there because she's surrounded by Seneca women who have a say in their society, who work alongside men, who own their own property. She saw natural rights for women. So to kind of create a slightly different framework of looking at the history of women's rights in the United States, and also to see what happened after the vote, because one of the things that happens, and you see this over and over in history, is after this many, many decades-long fight where women died for the vote, the vote happens, and then you have this falling off of feminism.
Yeah.
More women graduated from college in the 1930s than in the 1950s. And more women had professional careers in the 1930s and 40s than in the 50s and 60s. And that's,
the war may have had some impact.
It had
that,
a huge impact.
You know.
But at the same time, we have to keep relearning our history. And I think we've seen just in the last few years, women's rights are under attack. And you can't just sit back and go, okay, everything's fine now. So it's a, you know, the word vote comes from voice, and it's a little bit of an exhortation of women to use their voice. One of the reasons why it's important to know history is to know where you've come from, right? And why things look the way they do. You know, the ERA is being resuscitated right now, and
this is the Equal Rights Amendment that has been up for ratification since 1970.
Oh no, since before then.
It's been ratified by however many states. It has to hit a certain
36. It has to hit,
and it's in the it's like either in the low 30s or in the high 20s.
I think it's in the low 30s. I should know this. I'm so embarrassed, but it's been there for supposedly.
But it expired
in 82. But then it turned out maybe that wasn't a real thing. It was just a thing they thought. I don't know. It's not clear to me. But, you know, the Equal Rights Amendment, when I was a kid, was a huge movement, the fight for it.
Yeah.
And there was a kind of crushing effect when it didn't pass. So it'll be interesting to see what happens in the next few years, because I think it was Virginia just voted to pass the ERA. So we'll see. That would be shocking. Shocking turn of events.
Do you have a favorite, you know, kind of little story from the book that you think represents what you wanted the book to be?
The new book or
the broad strokes.
Broad strokes.
Yeah.
Can I just quickly say about the new book that it's also illustrated by 100 women artists for the 100 year anniversary? Yeah, I forgot to say that.
100 artists. That's that is quite the feat.
I know pulling
100 of anything together is a lot. But people who have to actually produce work. Artists
pulling in the same direction on a deadline.
Artists who are famously hard to wrangle.
So that's.
But in broad strokes specifically, is there something that, you know, is representative of, like, when you set out to do it, this is the reason, or this kind of represents why, you know?
I think it's a story that I'm going to tell tonight at the Philbrook in depth. Is this going to come out before tonight? No. So no spoilers.
Yeah, please, spoil
away. I'm going to spoil away. So I think, you know, she's probably the least established artist of all the artists in the book is Marie-Denise Vierre, who was a painter in the late 18th, early 19th century in France. We only have a few of her works that we know of. And her major portrait, called The Portrait of Charlotte de Valdun, which was donated to the Metropolitan Museum of Art in, I believe, 1917, was donated as a Jacques-Louis David, was believed to be David, was believed by the family who had owned it for generations to be by David. David is probably the greatest painter of the late, or greatest quote-unquote painter of late 18th century France. And it was one of the most popular paintings in the Met for generations, revered, lauded, called a masterpiece by many, many great art historians. And then in the 1980s, it came out, or actually, no, I'm sorry, in the 1950s, it came out that it was not by Jacques-Louis David and was in fact by a woman artist. And immediately, the cachet of the painting plummeted. And you had all these critics come forward and say, it's actually not that good of a painting. It's actually, it betrays many feminine weaknesses. A hand of David's would never have made such mistakes. A lot of backtracking about how good it was. To me, that's the perfect example, right? That here you have an absolute incredible moment in history that this young woman under Napoleon, who was brutal to women artists.
About the work.
The work is exactly the same. That she, persevered, created indisputably a masterpiece that has moved thousands of people for hundreds of years, is still one of the most beloved paintings in the Met, that nothing changed, but it is no longer of value because it wasn't by a male artist that we respected. To me, that's the perfect sort of rubric for what women face. That she ever was able to make this painting in the first place is quite a miracle. The sitter was also a female artist who got married and then did not continue as an artist, also a very common story. And then she's completely erased from history and her work subsumed under the work of a male artist. It's a very common story.
Having done, you mentioned you've done 50 or so events around the book, and you've talked about a lot, and you've probably done ad nauseum media about it, but I wonder, when you've gone on TV, or you've done a radio interview, or you've done a print interview, do you see or feel a different response from women journalists and men who cover the, do you kind of see any kind of low-level sexism?
Not really.
That kind of reflects how people, are they flip about the book at all?
I have to say, from the time the book first came out to now, it is a completely different time in terms of women in art. I mean, it was just one of those zeitgeist moments that Broad Strokes came out when suddenly there was, after so long, an interest in women artists in history. I don't know what happened. I'd been interested in this story and had really been kind of obsessed with women artists since I was a teenager, and I'm 52. So to see the sudden change, I mean, right now in 2020, there's going to be more museum shows in the United States dedicated to women artists than any time in the history of America. Places like the Baltimore Museum are only going to show women artists for a year. It's a completely different, it's the difference between, it seemed kind of like wacky and niche, and now it seems totally of the moment 3 years later.
We just interviewed Christopher Bedford from the Baltimore Museum about that about that decision to do that. Some people have made comments about it being kind of a publicity stunt. Will it really make a difference?
So what?
Well, Well, I wonder about that. Do you think that we're in a moment that is, you know, trendy, we're tied in with, you know, sometimes anniversaries, like we're talking about this women's suffrage. Year. Or is this something that you feel like is kind of locked in now?
We won't know if it's locked in. It is just a publicity stunt right now. Until collectors begin to buy the work of women artists, that's the only way things will really change. Because the way the art world is set up is driven by auction prices. So until that changes, I don't know that there will really be a solid change. I mean, if you look at contemporary collections in the United States, I think it's like less than 17% are women artists. Contemporary, right? More than 50% of MFA graduates are women. So, and if you look at auction prices, I mean, it's even more extreme.
But even auction prices, you're going to have to see at even a higher level leadership at the auction houses, leadership at the museums, leadership at
it has to start
galleries,
there.
You know?
It has to start there. Mm-hmm. But yeah, really, galleries are where a lot of it has to happen too. If galleries don't start showing more women, and if buyers aren't interested in buying them, I mean, it's like this upward spiral, right? Investment breeds interest, breeds careers, getting into good collections, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Things like that, that is how you have huge change.
That's our show for this week. Museum Confidential is produced and edited by Scott Gregory at the studios of Public Radio Tulsa. To learn more about what's going on at the museum and at the station, visit philbrook.org or publicradiotulsa.org or both. We suggest both. Until next time, look closer.